Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a week of wrangling in Washington as tensions over the economy and how to save it run high. Last night, President Obama at a Democratic Party retreat took issue with critics who call the stimulus bill a spending bill.
What do you think a stimulus is? That's the whole point. No, seriously. That's the point.
On the Senate floor yesterday, Republican Lindsey Graham said the parties are not working together on the package.
I am telling you right now that if this is the solution to George Bush's problems, the country is going to get worse. If this is the new way of doing business, if this is the change we all can believe in, America's best days are behind her.
And Iranian rockets this week launched Iran's first satellite into orbit to cries of God is great. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to launch the stimulus? Will Democrats and Republicans ultimately get it done? Should the Dems do it almost alone? We have a terrific panel with us this week. With us from Washington, Jonathan Wiseman, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good to have you back, Jonathan.
Happy to be here.
And from Miami, Michael Grunwald, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. It's been a while, Mike. Glad you're here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Jonathan.
Let's listen to some more of Barack Obama last night with Democrats, finally getting a little frustrated.
We can't delay and we can't go back to the same worn-out ideas that led us here in the first place. In the last few days, we've seen proposals arise from some in Congress that you may not have read, but you'd be very familiar with because you've been hearing them for the last 10 years, maybe longer. They're rooted in the idea that tax cuts alone can solve all our problems, that government doesn't have a role to play, that half measures and tinkering are somehow enough.
And that wasn't all. He went on to say it's got to be a new approach.
We are not going to get relief by turning back to the very same policies that for the last 8 years, doubled the national debt and threw our economy into a tailspin.
Jonathan Wiseman, what is going on in the stimulus debate? What's at play here?
Well, you know, President Obama tried bipartisanship. He talked about getting 80 votes on the stimulus bill. And in the last 2 days, he's really turned on a dime. He's been under a lot of pressure from Democratic leadership, Democratic rank and file, to really start getting out there and using his own personal popularity. There was a closed-door meeting of senators on Wednesday in which Barbara Boxer said, you need to get out there, get in people's faces, and he's taking it to heart. I mean, we heard that language start cropping up on Wednesday. It really sharpened up on Thursday at a speech at the Energy Department, and then he was really riffing last night. He is beginning to realize that this whole notion of post-partisanship is seemed to be lost on his opposition. I mean, the terms of this debate are very familiar. It's large government versus small government, interventionism versus tax cuts. And he's deciding to take up the cudgel now.
Michael Grunwald, you've gone very deep on the stimulus package this week in Time Magazine. Your piece is headlined, "What is Real Stimulus and What Isn't?" How do you see this debate, Michael? Is this about how we fix the economy? Is this about political philosophy? Can you separate the two?
Well, I think it is about both. I mean, in one respect, President Obama has a real nice hand to play, not only because he's so popular right now, but because the Republicans have really lost a lot of credibility on this. They're sitting here saying that this stimulus package is horrible. It's going to explode the debt. And meanwhile, their alternatives are, make President Bush's tax cuts permanent and reduce permanently reduce taxes for the highest earners who sort of need it least and will spend it the least. It's going to explode the debt even more. You know, you hear them talking about how there's too much pork, and then they come up with an alternative, which is, you know, to 500% increase in funding for the Army Corps of Engineers, which is like, you know, the federal bureaucracy's Oscar Mayer. So I think, it's a kind of nice position for President Obama to be in, to be able to say, hey, you know, I was elected on change. We need to do what Keynes said and pour some money into the economy, but we also need to do it in a way that invests in the future and essentially promotes his priorities that he talked about during the campaign in terms of sustainable energy, in terms of, you know, spreading the wealth a little bit, like Joe the Plumber said, and in terms of promoting our long-term economic competitiveness.
Jack Beatty, nice hand to play. I don't know. I mean, I'm reading free fall, edge of catastrophe on the economy here. Maybe nice, but also really ugly out there.
Really ugly, and quite a gap between the Republican nostrums and that crisis. You know, Jim DeMint, the Republican senator from South Carolina, submitted an amendment that got 36 of 41 Republican votes. And that would have, to pick up on Jonathan, on Michael, that would have lowered the tax rates by 10% on the top earners. It would have permanently eliminated the estate tax for most rich people. It would have repealed the alternative minimum tax for everyone, on and on. It was all spending. It was all tax cuts, no spending. That's where that caucus is. And I think, as the president rightly says, if you take that cure against our problem, it just doesn't fit. And of course, what's driving this, what always drives policy, is politics. The Republicans, you know, they want a recovery. They just don't want it to come before 2010. The Democrats want the biggest possible stimulus so they can run in 2010. We have revived the economy.
Jonathan Weissman, I wonder if it's really that simple. I'm reading at the same time, page one, New York Times today. Japan was in a ditch for all of the 90s, still has problems, looks back on trillions in public works and infrastructure and stimulative spending, and a whole lot of it didn't work. So are the Republicans necessarily wrong here?
Well, we're at a situation where, it's hurry up and do something, and there's very little left in the quivers. Now, the Federal Reserve, the Republicans like to use monetary policy, cutting interest rates and increasing the money supply to get us out of these situations. The Federal Reserve has already cut interest rates practically to zero. Nobody is spending money. Most people acknowledge that if you give tax cuts, that those tax cuts are going to be used to save, to pay down debt. Right now, the only organization, the only entity out there that is willing to spend money is the Obama administration. And frankly, that's what the economy needs. There just aren't a lot of choices left.
Maybe not. Here's Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, though, saying the stimulus measure is getting out of control.
The president has tried to set some priorities. Unfortunately, Democrats just keep throwing more money on top of an already incredibly bloated bill. At some point, we're going to have to learn to say no. If we're going to help the economy, we need to get a hold of this bill, and making it bigger isn't the answer.
Michael Grunwald, nevertheless, it's gotten bigger in the Senate. They may cut something out of it. They may find a compromise. Where do you see this going, Mike?
Well, it's hard to say. It really is going to depend a lot on President Obama and how tough he's going to be. I mean, the idea that President Obama kind of needs to beg Congress to spend the money, it's kind of silly. It's like begging Cookie Monster to eat. They're going to end up spending a lot of money. The question is really how tough Obama is going to be about pushing for his own priorities. And again, I don't want to suggest that. I mean, there are some real problems with the stimulus bill. Not enough reform, too many blank checks to states to kind of spend money the same way they've always done it. But I think for some of the Republican leaders, there's a real credibility problem when you hear them saying things like, you know, the government never created a job. I mean, a job in biomedical research or even teaching about herpes to teenagers, you know, it may sound funny, but it's a job. And so, there are legitimate questions about how these jobs are going to be created. But the idea that just because the government is somehow involved in creating them, they're not jobs is kind of silly.
Jack, I hear you there.
And the great irony here is that This is a bill that came into the Senate around $800 billion. The first big expansion came when Republican Senator Chuck Grassley added a one-year fix to the alternative minimum tax. That pushed it up to $900 billion. Then Johnny Isaacson, a Republican from the from Georgia, added a really big lucrative tax cut for home buyers, not just first-time home buyers, any home buyer. Mm-hmm. Then a bipartisan amendment added a tax cut for purchasing cars. It's up to $920+ billion right now, not because Democrats are adding spending, but because Republicans are adding tax cuts.
Jack, we're looking at these numbers coming in on unemployment today, though. This isn't funny. We need to get this figured out. The abyss, Paul Krugman says, is facing us. He's a liberal, but even conservatives looking out there and saying, where are we sliding to here economically?
We're indeed, and of course the official unemployment is 7.6, but if you put in discouraged workers and others, you can get up to 9.5%. Some people even think 12%. And yet in the face of this, this compromise that the so-called moderate senators seem to be working out would actually prevent unemployed people from filing for Medicaid and would reduce, would make COBRA the sort of interim insurance program to get you to insure you before you get another job. It wouldn't do anything on to make that easier for people. I'm just afraid that this fix that seems to be shaping up is going to hurt on the long-term investments, especially in education. You know, Tom, you mentioned that piece about Japan in today's Times. They say that Japan found that the best expenditure, the most stimulative, both in the short and long term, was money on education.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the stimulus struggle, a cap on CEO pay, surgery for Ginsburg, Daschle out, partisanship, full bloom in Washington this week. Jonathan Wiseman of the Wall Street Journal joins us. Michael Grunwald is here from Time Magazine and our own Jack Beatty. A lot of work on a fix in the Senate. By the time you hear this, it could have passed. But here's Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who's been working with Maine Senators Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins to cut billions out of the stimulus plan, saying they're trying to maximize the effectiveness of the initiative.
A lot of items that are solid public policy items that can be in other locations because they're not a stimulative, although very good, can be put in other. We're scrubbing that out and keeping in that we think is the most stimulative.
And here's Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins, one of a couple of votes that would be critical if the Democrats decide to just push it through, saying the process has been slow, but there are signs of hope.
We are making good progress. We've agreed to tens of billions of dollars of adjustments, and I think we're making good progress.
Sure. Billions all over the place, but no package yet at this hour. Christopher in Harrisonburg, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen.
What do you think?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a civil engineer outside of New York originally. I just got laid off as part of the recent layoffs. And, man, I'll tell you what, I'm out there, I'm interviewing, I just bought a new suit, and I'm not, absolutely not, looking for the government to facilitate in my employment. And it's a disgrace to me to think that, and I understand that, you know, their ambitions and they have political motives and whatnot. It would be kind of naive not to acknowledge that, but you know, at some point, we're either going to go the socialist route or we're not. And to grow the government to spend money where there's not money being made and to play into the economy like this, it's not going to result in anything positive.
But, Christopher, were we socialists in the 30s, in the 50s, in the 60s? Was Dwight Eisenhower socialist when he built the interstate highway? I mean, you're a laid-off civil engineer and you still don't want a stimulus package?
Absolutely not. Now, I'll explain to you why really quickly. And it's a big comparison between Reagan and what happened in the 30s. You invested a lot in the highway infrastructure. It's fantastic. That's great. But we had inflation that was drawn out far longer than was necessary. And look at Reagan. The only way to promote long-term growth in the economy is to get people out there investing and creating businesses.
Long-term until now. Christopher, we hear it. Jonathan Wiseman, what do you make of American politics now? You hear a laid-off civil engineer who doesn't want a stimulus package. Even he's got no job, and we're all hearing the economic numbers.
Well, in his inaugural address, President Obama made the assertion that we've moved beyond the debates over big government versus small government, what can government do versus what it cannot do, and that the ground has shifted beneath those still making these arguments. But as you're hearing, in fact, the divisions over ideology between the proper role of government have not changed. Now, obviously, on the margins, the voters are now favoring more intervention. That's hence a Democratic sweep in November. But the Republicans have not ceased to exist, and the small government creed is still very much out there.
Michael Grunwald, how do you hear that call? Laid off civil engineer, no to stimulus.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's you know, I heard one congressman on C-SPAN the other day talking about how it was crazy to think the government can create jobs. The Great Depression didn't end until World War II, as if the government wasn't spending any money during World War II. I mean, you know, for civil engineers, they need jobs repairing roads. They need jobs, you know, retrofitting federal buildings. I saw that's one of, and I think there's some legitimate critics. You know, like we heard Senator Nelson and Senator Collins, they're trying to streamline the bill. But they want to take out money to make federal buildings more energy efficient. Well, that's terrific stimulus. Not only is it going to put engineers to work and guys with caulk guns, but it's also going to reduce long-term federal energy costs. You know, you can reduce the energy cost 40% by retrofitting a building, and it's immediate stimulus. So again, I think these fights over the details are going to be important, but ultimately, it's going to be, are you spending the money smart? Is it going to help the economy quickly? But also in the long term, is it going to promote national priorities that are going to reduce our long-term debt and really get the economy going?
Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Debbie. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I think that it is wonderful that Obama tried to reach out to the Republicans and reach across the aisle to get something going. But if they're going to fight this tooth and nail, then he needs to step up and do what he's been doing in the last couple of days by, you know, saying what the facts are. And the facts are that the tax cuts that we've had over the years have led us to this point, and we just can't go that route anymore.
Debbie, we've got it. Jonathan Wiseman, how do you see this unfolding finally? There's a combination here of deal making and, you know, big billboard politics. Where do you see this settling out?
Well, you know, I was speaking to a fairly senior senator last week off the record who said that, look, really, the Republicans don't want this bill to die. They want it to be signed into law. They just want to vote against it. That way, look, it's a fairly cynical take, but if the economy turns around, hey, you know, the political atmosphere will be great for incumbents. They'll be fine. If the economy doesn't turn around, they can say, we voted against this. We told you so. What they don't want it to do is just die as a stinking, rotting carcass in the Senate. So I do not believe this is going to die to a filibuster. I think when Mitch McConnell said yesterday he wants to move the process along and get it to conference, the House-Senate negotiations, that was a signal to a few Republicans, look, you can vote against the filibuster, vote to move the process forward, and look, and in the end, you know, you'll get another bite at the apple. I think this bill is going to get into law. And remember, look, if it gets cut down to $800 billion, the president initially sent it up to Capitol Hill at $775 billion. Let's remember in 2001, President Bush sent up a $1.7 trillion tax cut. It was sliced back down to $1.35 trillion. At the time, Democrats thought they had really, you know, accomplished something.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody remembers a Democratic victory in 2001. That $1.35 trillion tax cut was still a huge victory for President Bush, and an $800 billion stimulus will be a huge victory for Barack Obama if it happens.
Let's go to Linda in North Haverhill, New Hampshire. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I just hope you listen to me for a minute here. You know, Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky, has been against Obama and everything the Democrats stand for years. He was the one who kept voting over and over again for this war in Iraq and the billions that we've thrown away there. Also, his friend Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, that United States senator, has been quoted many times before the election of saying, God help us all if Obama is elected. So what you've got here is a group of people who are angry, number one, because of the election happened and the Republicans got their butt kicked. And number two, they're still out there protecting that 20% of America that hasn't felt this recession and probably won't, because they're the Madoff people who have screwed us around so much that we're all poor from the money they've stolen.
Well, a lot of Madoff people feeling it right now as well, but we take your point, Linda. Jack Beatty, what about it? Here was Barack Obama reaching out loud and clear to Republicans. Maybe the hand hasn't come back exactly. Was, in your view, was he right to do that, Jack, or was that a mistake? Should he have just rolled on his priorities?
He was right to do it, and I think it's a very important signal. He ran on the idea of bipartisanship and achieving comity across the aisle. Unfortunately, you know, when you think about it, what would bipartisanship mean? Well, it would mean that both parties essentially got their way even Steven, which is to say the status quo. Nothing would happen. Our system is party government, whether we like it or not. And I think that the Republicans are showing their mettle. I mean, they, you know, as we suggested last week, they're finding their voice. They hated having to spend so much money during the Bush years. All those Bush programs really just made them feel that they were abandoning their conservative compass. Now they're back on their old, we are against spending, period. And Mitch McConnell, you know, he over the weekend, he said the government wants to spend $150 million on honeybee insurance. What an awful thing. Well, it turns out, of course, it isn't just honeybee insurance. It's all sorts of insurance for livestock producers and others to protect them against catastrophe. And last year, McConnell voted for the very bill, for the very program that he's attacking. So the typical demagoguery there. I mean, I think if Obama can be faulted, it's on this. The debate got away from him. It got down to specific programs, and it got down to efficiency, and it got away from macroeconomic effectiveness and the whole idea of the bounce. I think now what he was trying to do yesterday was to call back and say, look, we have a huge crisis. History says the only way we get out of this is if the government essentially tries to make up that $2 trillion shortfall expected in the economy over the next 2 years.
We'll talk stimulus all you like, but there's a lot going on out there. The White House laid out limits on executive pay this week, a $500,000 salary cap for American corporations going forward that take major bailout money from the federal government. Here was Obama explaining his rationale.
This is America. We don't disparage wealth. We don't begrudge anybody for achieving success. And we certainly believe that success should be rewarded. But what gets people upset, and rightfully so, are executives being rewarded for failure, especially when those rewards are subsidized by U.S. taxpayers, many of whom are having a tough time themselves.
And so a $500,000 salary cap if you take big money from the federal government. Here's chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable, Scott Talbot, saying that capping executive salaries could drain the pool of talented executives.
Executives who have the education, experience, and know-how to operate and run a global financial services firm is very small. And so limiting their ability for the market to reward them, to compensate them for those unique set of skills, could have a chilling effect at a time when the industry and the economy needs that expertise now.
Jonathan Wiseman, Wall Street Journal, what do you make of the $500,000 cap? What is the effect of that likely to be? And is it for real?
Well, is it for real is a good question. We have, under this plan, two tiers of companies. There's the extraordinary company. These are companies like AIG, the great insurance giant that was basically federalized, nationalized when it was on death's door, or Bank of America that got a very special deal from the federal government so it could take over Merrill Lynch before Merrill Lynch went under. Under these extraordinary circumstances, the the top five executives would have this $500,000 salary cap.
Except, of course, in those particulars, it won't, because it's not retroactive, at least not,
exactly.
Not now.
This is not, mm-hmm. So, and it would only apply to extraordinary circumstances going forward. For any other company that's getting more general programs from the great $700 billion bailout going forward, they also have a $500,000 cap, but that cap can be waived if they explain to the Treasury Department why they need to pay more than that, and if they get a non-binding vote from shareholders on executive compensation. The shareholders could turn down $1 million salary and they could still go forward with it. So, look, conceivably, not a single company could be hit by that $500,000 salary cap if there are no more AIGs or Merrill Lynches in the future. So don't get too excited about it. I think it was a masterstroke politically, because a lot of people, first of all, think that there is going to be this big cap. It was a great punchline on the comedy shows this week, saying, you know, cry me a river on your $500,000. And remember, this is in some ways artillery fire that the president is laying down on the American people before he lays out the next iteration of the bailout on Monday. His Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, will be saying what he's going to do going forward for the big financial services companies with that extra $350 billion. Before he can do that, he needs to show Americans that he, too, is outraged, even though he's about to give them a whole lot more money.
Let's go to Rich in Barnett, Vermont. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My point is, I would like to see that any corporation that's taking money from the federal government under the TARP or any other program that comes down the pike, their executive officers shouldn't make more than $1 a year.
$1?
$1. And I don't believe that they have 1,000 places to run to and find another job, such as Dubai. And I don't believe that the number of people that have this capability is that small.
So $1, you can make more than that at McDonald's, but we've got the perspective. Let's go to Dean in Newton, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a Republican, currently disgusted with Republicans, and maybe soon to be independent. I had an original comment on the stimulus, that it's just time for Obama to just push Democrats forward and just, you know,
do it.
Take into account the mandate that they clearly had.
Okay.
And the rest of us are going to have to, you know, just suck it up and get behind it. I mean, it's clearly, you know, sitting around and like, you know, when I hear Lindsey Graham making comments that America's best days are behind her. If this,
yeah, that sounds
change,
bad. What about a salary cap, my wavering Republican?
Well, I agree that the salary cap is an excellent idea. And, I mean, I just heard a few seconds ago somebody talking about the talent required to run these conglomerates. Well, you know what? I know a lot of small business owners that would love to teach them a thing or two about being fiscally conservative. So maybe we need to start looking elsewhere.
Dean, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Michael Gruenwald, isn't this going to affect a lot of people with this second round? Even the big companies Jonathan's talking about, they're coming back for more. The hole is still deep and not filled.
Well, I think both of your callers are on to something that's a very important lesson, both for TARP, for the financial bailout, and the stimulus, which is that if you pass these gigantic bailouts without strings attached, you should not expect the people receiving the money to behave the way you want them to. You know, it should be federal money, fine. Then you're going to have to move towards these federal priorities. The original financial bailout, there was essentially they could spend it however they wanted, and then people were upset when they didn't make loans. Well, no, why should they make loans? There were no requirements to make loans. This is going to be very important for the stimulus, because, you know, if you just give the, even if you're giving the money to states to do infrastructure with a blank check, you know, they're going to just build sprawl roads if you don't tell them, hey, you need to fix your roads first. You need to build mass transit that's going to move us, you know, towards energy independence. So I think this is a lesson for the financial bailout, too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael Phelps in hot water, a peanut butter victim, and cool hands on the Hudson this week. Olympic champ Michael Phelps lost his Kellogg's endorsement deal when a photo of him smoking pots hit the tabloids.
I clearly made some bad, bad judgments and mistakes in my life, and you know, I think the best thing is learn from your mistakes.
Jeff Almer, son of a salmonella victim, spoke out in Washington where Capitol Hill hearings on the great peanut butter scare were underway.
While in rehab, she had unknowingly eaten salmonella-laced peanut butter while in her immune-compromised state of health. Cancer couldn't claim her, but peanut butter did.
Peanut butter did, and tape of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 is out. Here's the tower and Captain Cool, Chesley Sullenberger, as the Big Bird went down.
He lost thrust in both engines, he said.
Got it.
Check is 1529. We can get it for you. Do you want to try to land 1013?
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
In the Hudson, and they did. Michael Grunwald of Time Magazine is with us. Jonathan Wiseman of the Wall Street Journal is here, and our own Jack Beatty. Isabella in Richmond, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I think those who are seeking aid from the government should accept the cap of $500,000. If they don't want to accept, then the process should work, because those companies will look for alternative methods to bail out their companies, which in turn will create ideas for others to seek help from the private sector. Therefore, less money will be spent from the government.
Isabella, we've got it. Jonathan, this is where I'm not sure how this really plays out. Those CEOs and the others, in the ranks who would be affected are not going to want to be capped at $500,000 when they're used to making many millions. I mean, I don't know, that's the fresh flower bill in the mansion in Greenwich. So does it mean that they wouldn't take the money and just let the bank go down? Or how does it play out practically, Jonathan?
Well, the reason they set it up where the most stringent limits go on the companies getting extraordinary help is that they figure these companies are in such dire straits, they will just have no choice. The caller says they can, if they don't want the caps, they'll try to do something else. Well, the thought is there is nothing else for them to do. Now, the fear is that there will be banks, healthier banks, that won't want this pay cap to deal with. They won't want all these strings attached, mm-hmm. and they won't go there. Now they'll be fine. They'll just bumble along as they are, but they won't be lending. They won't be helping the economy. The fear is that you're going to scare away the institutions that you need most, because these are the institutions that have the capacity to start lending out money to get the arteries unclogged in the financial system and get money flowing into this economy again.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Ken. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ken.
I just got a couple points and then a question. It just dawned on me listening to that lady talk.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to cap these guys' money, are they going to figure into the stimulus package the amount of taxes they're going to lose from the millions the guy would have paid in taxes?
So you want a little negative deficit line off what they would have paid on that. Okay. What else?
Well, is America's memory so short-term that she's forgot what Reagan did? He never put out a stimulus package. He cut tax rates, cut the corporate tax rates, which America's is the highest in the world. And 15 years of gorgeous economy. Bill Clinton comes along and doesn't do nothing to shore it up, which, we never had anything like that for so long sustained.
Of course, we did have in those Reagan years a pretty big deficit, a record deficit for the time underneath those economic returns. But we take your point, Jack Beatty. Ken in Nashville wants to say, has everybody forgotten the beauty of Reagan's economy?
Well, there was much to recommend it, and inflation, the real achievement there was that inflation came down dramatically, and I think that was the precondition for the growth that we saw thereafter. But this question about the pay cap, Obama is, I think, trying to introduce a post-Gilded Age norm here. The Gilded Age, our second Gilded Age, is crashing all around us. It's assumptions. It's property scams. It's, it's boodles, Florida real estate. It's all coming down. And the illusions are falling away. And the norm the idea, you know, people's ideas of value and what should or should not be done, those things are very important in economics. Two economists at MIT wrote a very important paper last year pointing out, you know, what was it that defined American equality, rough equality, in the post-war era? They found three things: strong labor unions, a strong public sector, high marginal tax rates on the rich, and cultural norms about you don't take too much. That there was nothing stopping the greedy CEO, say, in 1965 when he earned 19 times what the average worker earned. There was nothing stopping him from going from 21, but he didn't do it. There were different norms. We now have a president saying, let's think about the whole. We can't be ripping off the whole society. I think this is very important. Theodore Roosevelt, you know, when he ended the Gilded Age, or it ended in his day, it was a lot of it was phrase making. When he talked about the malefactors of great wealth, He was crystallizing a moral norm, an imperative. And I think this is how change starts.
Tim Egan, writing in the New York Times, Americans don't resent wealth, but there's class resentment when there's no performance. When it's big money for bad performance, you may get a different response. Speaking of illusions falling away, we had whistleblower Harry Markopoulos this week really going after both the Madoff story and the Securities and Exchange Commission before a House subcommittee. Here he is taking the SEC to task for neglecting his warnings about the Madoff Ponzi scheme.
I gift-wrapped and delivered the largest Ponzi scheme in history to them, and somehow they couldn't be bothered to conduct a thorough and proper investigation because they were too busy on matters of higher priority. If a $50 billion Ponzi scheme doesn't make the SEC's priority list, then I want to know who sets their priorities.
Okay, there's one angry guy who said he tried to tell them they did nothing about it. Of course, talk about a gilded age. A lot of guilds stripped off in the Madoff story. Michael Grunwald, you're looking at all this. What do you see?
Well, I think there is a legitimate backlash against this notion that just a few years ago, these guys were getting $100 million bonus packages, and it was because they were so brilliant. They were the masters of the universe. And then suddenly everything crashed, and they need bailouts because it's not their fault. And in fact, they actually need, you know, it's ridiculous to cap their salaries because otherwise these guys are in such demand, having, you know, driven their banks into a ditch, that otherwise they'll go somewhere else. I actually have my own modest proposal,
okay,
which is that if these banks, you know, what's bringing them down is they have all this kind of toxic junk, this paper that that's not quite as toxic as people think it is, but it's bringing them down, and at the same time they have, you know, they can't, by no means can't cut their salaries for their employees who are so incredibly valuable. I don't see why they, you know, maybe cap their salaries at, say, about what an NPR host makes, perhaps.
Oh,
and then
they're gonna have to move in a hurry
and give them their bonus in the toxic junk. Well, presumably they keep telling us that in, you know, just wait a few years and that stuff's going to be worth billions. In fact, UBS has started to talk about doing that for some of their executives, and it seems like it, you know, solves all the problems.
And yet, I mean, yes, and yet we can't, you know, we've still got to have incentives on the other side of this for people to come to work and build an economy. Brad in Florence, South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Brad?
I just have a question, you know, as a libertarian. I'd say that the federal government has taken into account how little someone can make, and now they've taken into account how much someone can make. And as an entity that has, you know, produces no goods, no commodity, has really no foot in the marketplace whatsoever besides the legislation, how can they justify that they can tell you how little or how much that someone can make?
Well, what about when taxpayers like you and me, Brad, are bailing these companies out at in the billions and billions and billions, maybe trillions?
These guys are on welfare.
Once again, a stupid business decision made by someone, by an entity that has no standing in the marketplace. You know, what gives them any thought that they would have make any good decisions for a marketplace?
Libertarian Brad, I understand your philosophy, but you lose me right now because they're in the marketplace up to their neck. So are you and I, bailing out banks. But I hear you. Let's go to James in Peabody, Massachusetts. James, you're on the air.
Yes. My first point is there needs to be a cap on all corporate and on small business as well. These people have to understand that the people that are working underneath them are running their business and keeping their business afloat. So there definitely needs to be a cap put on all corporate giants throughout the world, never mind the United States. If we fall, the entire world falls.
But now you're going somewhere else there, James. I mean, this is just for companies who take big bailouts. You would do it across the board? I mean, is that really a system that motivates incentives?
Not necessarily across the board. I mean, entrepreneurs also need to pay their help a little bit more money as well. But, yes, on a higher level, the corporate giants need to stop playing golf every day and going on their lavish trips and buying $15 million airplanes and start giving back what they have earned from their, you know, their the hard work that they've done is not done just by them. It's done by the people underneath them.
Yeah, we hear a little culture shift maybe going on here. Let's go to Waverly, Iowa, and Linda. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a disillusioned Republican that bought into the concept of hope and change, and I'm kind of disappointed because what I see coming from the Obama administration is just a rehash of the Clinton administration, and I think that this CAP program and even a lot of the stimulus package is kind of like reissuing that old adage of substituting style for substance.
$1 trillion, $2 trillion is style? It sounds like a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. If it can be geared right, maybe it might do some benefit. I can't really see where it's going to necessarily help too many of the people, really. I could spend an hour telling you my situation, but that's not the point. The point is that what you need to do is you need to not continually put people in positions that have shown themselves to be crooks time and time again. You need to not justify, you know, even the Kellogg thing with Michael Phelps. He lost. That's probably a little more style than substance because he did lose that deal, but it's going to blow over in a couple of days. And really, is smoking marijuana as bad as using steroids?
I don't know. When you're on the cover of the Wheaties box or whatever it is, it may just not fly. We've got some other issues.
Can I jump in here for a
second? Yeah, please.
I want to address what the caller is talking about. You know, President Obama, when he was campaigning, didn't talk about bipartisanship. He didn't talk about kind of split the difference politics that Jack was talking about earlier. He talked about post-partisanship. He talked about somehow finding a way forward that put the old arguments behind us. But he was never very specific. He never told us what that would look like. Now he's in power, and he's having to actually, you know, put legislation together. And what he's finding, and what we're all finding, is there is no post-partisanship. We're still doing legislation that's basically along the same lines that we've been doing one way or the other for the last 20 years. And callers like the one that was just on the air are finding that the rhetoric of the Obama campaign doesn't necessarily look like what they're seeing. The Obama campaign, candidate Obama, was anybody the person wanted him to be. Well, now we're seeing what that person is, and there's going to be a natural division reemerging between Democrats and Republicans.
Michael Gunwald, though, you might think that the severity of the economic God knows what that we're facing might beat a little bit of the partisanship out of our politics.
Well, it doesn't seem to have done that, but it does, and this is you guys laughed a little at the beginning when I said this sort of plays into Obama's hand. I mean, he really does have a crisis, and he gets to use it. You know, you have these Republicans who are sort of they're kind of the equivalent of the guy who sort of inherited a lot of money and then spent it all on hookers and coke, and now suddenly has decided, now that his kid needs an operation, that that it's time to pay off the credit cards. And Obama's saying, no, this is a crisis. You know, this is and meanwhile, of course, you have the Republicans putting out, you know, with only four senators voting no, a basic plan for more hookers and coke. You know, they're sort of tax cuts for the top of the spending scale.
I'm not sure that's how they define it.
Well, they probably wouldn't call it that. But essentially, sort of more hair of the dog that bit you. While Obama's kind of saying, like, here, you know, I said change, and, you know, we're going to do it my way. And I think he's got, you know, certainly at least in the first couple weeks of his administration, he's got a pretty good argument to make that say, like, hey, these guys, you know, I want to do it a different way, but these guys are just saying, let's keep doing it the same way. That's going to be a pretty tough argument for, you know, that allows him to say, hey, you know, I tried bipartisanship, but you know, these guys just don't want to play. They want to double down on George Bush. And then, obviously, you know, the real test will be whether it works.
But will he have 60 votes in the Senate, Jack? You got 58, including Al Franken there. That's not 60 Democrats.
That's not 60. And the agreement he made with Judd Gregg, my senator here in New Hampshire, is getting to look a little dubious, at least at this hour. Judd Gregg is going to be his Commerce Secretary. But Judd recused himself from voting on the stimulus bill. Now, if that bill goes down by one vote, boy, Obama is not going to look very shrewd on that.
Gregg was not going to vote for it. He recused himself because it would have been very embarrassing for the Commerce Secretary to vote against it.
You know, I hadn't worked that out. He had been making some ambiguous statements, but you're clear that he wouldn't have voted for it. Well,
it's interesting because Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff of the White House, always seems to think that Judd Gregg is more on his side than Gregg ever seems to intimate he is. He had been making some ambiguous statements that were not exactly wholly in opposition, but Jack, you pointed out earlier in the show about these programs such as allowing unemployed workers to buy into Medicaid or allowing federal subsidies for COBRA. That's the program where you can buy into the insurance plan of the employer that just fired you. These are precisely the kind of programs that Judd Gregg hates because they're an expansion of existing programs that will be very difficult to turn off even when the economy finally turns around.
Well, the debate goes on, but the economy and its problems speak more and more and more loudly. Sooner or later, it feels like they're going to have all our attention. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Jonathan Weissman with the Wall Street Journal, thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Grunwald with Time Magazine. Great to have you, Mike.
Appreciate it, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Stay warm.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.